Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Maternity Live, episode 4. It's still exciting when we say the numbers of the episodes, just because we're really getting into the groove here. But my hope is that, like, one day when it's like episode 400, I won't be starting the podcast episode saying, "Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 400. I hope everybody is having a good week. I feel like for me personally, this week kind of went a little bit up and down for me. And before we get into all of my thoughts on everything going on in both my life and in the world, this episode will feature Dr. Christine Sterling. I'm super excited to talk to Dr. Sterling. She is an award-winning OBGYN. You guys can follow her at Dr. Sterling OBGYN on Instagram. Dr. Sterling obtained her bachelor's degree in neuroscience from the University of Southern California, where she graduated summa cum laude, and then she stayed at USC for her medical degree. She shares so many great tips, tricks, videos, you name it, all on her social media, where she's amassed a crazy amazing following, where she has just cultivated a community of moms, pregnant women, postpartum, pre-pregnancy, you name it. And she really offers all of her advice and expertise that she has learned delivering hundreds of babies. And I'm thrilled to not only be able to talk to her, but pick her brain about how coronavirus is potentially affecting pregnant women. And then also dealing with some of the anxieties, especially for postpartum women, as we're all, you know, really maneuvering through this pandemic from home. So stay tuned for Dr. Sterling in the back half of this episode. But in the meantime, let me tell you how I'm doing. Number one, I feel like I was doing really well in quarantine, and I still feel like I really am, because I've been really needing to take this time to just like be at home and take it easy, because my morning sickness has come back with a full on fucking vengeance. And some days I really can't even lift my head, and other days like I'm literally puking multiple times a day, which I've had morning sickness for most of my pregnancy, but like this is a whole other level. And two, I feel like not knowing when this was gonna end kind of just like kept me on my toes, that it could happen at any moment. And I distinctly remember this weekend when we found out that we are still following self-quarantining guidelines until April 30th. And I think that's kind of when I started to crack a little bit, because it just became so much more real. And the realness is another month of realness. So I go a little crazy in my own head. Plus the fact that I haven't been feeling well, it just all feels like so real. And now I'm like, I don't know how I'm gonna do this for another month. But the reality is that for me, today is day 19. And this was the first time that I left the house in 19 days. So I basically had already done a month. I guess when you're just not thinking about the days and the weeks and the months and never the years, but you just like don't even know how much time has passed. But now that I feel like we have like this very specific date deadline, it feels so far away and like so hard to attain. I don't know. I guess I need to go back to like not knowing what day of the week it was and not knowing how much longer we have or didn't have. I was just kind of like counting the days for fun. I didn't even remember like what day I had started all this. I had to go back into my calendar and remember that first Friday that I didn't leave the house is technically day one for me. And that was March 13th. But I never like thought of it as like March 13th to April 30th. And like, that's how I'm being right now. And I'm kind of psyching myself out, and that's not my personality. So like, I need to just hop out of that. But I also need to give myself like a day or two to like let it fucking register, because I was kind of living in a little bit of a la la land before, where I was like, we can do this, we can get through it. And we will do this, we will get through this. But I also feel like we should be able to complain about it. And that's exactly what I'm doing here. So anywho, there's a couple of things to check in on from last week, which is one of the big topics of last week's podcast was around support partners being allowed in the delivery room, especially in the state of New York. And some hospitals had placed restrictions on that, but the governor did overturn that ruling. So women now are allowed to have a support partner in the delivery room. It is monumental, wonderful, amazing. I'm so happy. And I'm so happy for all the reasons that you would think I would be happy. Of course, the obvious ones. But then there are the unobvious ones to you guys that, you know, like my husband not complaining anymore about how he was going to meet our child on the sidewalk outside the hospital, or just like his own anxiety around how he wasn't going to be able to meet his child from the second that the child was born into this world. And to be honest with you, like, he's right, but I just didn't need that kind of like added pressure of someone else feeling down about the situation in addition to all my anxieties about delivery and birth. And so that is another huge reason as to why I am extremely happy about this news, because I feel like one less thing for him to worry about is obviously then one less thing for me to worry about. And I don't want to worry about anything else in addition to everything that we already have to worry about as it relates to just like being pregnant and being pregnant in these crazy quarantine times. And then the other thing I did want to touch upon is intuitive eating. And my sister Jackie also touched upon it on the morning toast. And I'm telling you guys, it's a thing. It really is, because I am not even kidding you. Since March 11th, here I am, like, you know, being a human calendar again. But since March 11th, I have maintained my weight. And I have been eating like a queen. And I've been eating good. And I just want to say that, like, it is insane to me that I could, you know, maintain my weight while eating robust meals and having things like pasta and making things like cookies. And I really do think that the intuitive eating thing is a thing. And I hope to get somebody on the podcast soon to like help me dive deeper on it. But I promised you that I would check back in. And if it was a fluke, I would admit that it was a fluke. But it has not been a fluke for me. And it's kind of wild. I mean, at some point, obviously, like, I will start to increase my weight, I'm assuming, just given the fact that I'm fucking pregnant. But for this time period, I feel like I could have gained 10 pounds in those like 2.5 weeks during quarantine, and I didn't. And one, not only am I really impressed with myself, but two, I just also feel like I learned a lot about myself. And it's not all the time that I learn new things about myself. So I'm excited for me, because I feel like I uncovered something, and I feel, it makes me feel kind of like a little bit like a detective, like, ooh, like I'm experimenting, I'm going deep, I'm figuring things out, and go me. That's all I have to say. Go me. So as you guys know, this is Maternity Live, and what do we do here? We cover the big three, and my first big topic today is pretty timely to what's going on right now, which is the whole notion of working from home. Obviously, I have been very vocal about, you know, being a woman in business for most of my career. And from what I've learned throughout the course of my career is that working from home, people have always said that they are more productive working from home. Now, I think there are extremes, right? Like, most people have not been working from home day in, day out for weeks at a time like we are right now. But I do think that there is some truth in the productivity around working from home. I find that I have been like busier than ever. And part of it is, I think, getting myself into a routine. But also, working from home requires you to really put yourself out there more. And you're not just going to learn things from just walking past somebody in the office or overhearing something on a call or whatever it is. You actually have to put yourself out there and find out what the fuck is going on and figure out how to get your ass in there and get done what needs to get done. And I think actually there's a lot of good learnings that can come from working from home, because you really learn communication skills, which are so crucial and so important in the workplace. But you also learn how to be accountable for the things that you have to be accountable for. Like, when you're working from home, no one is waking up every day and telling you what to do. You are telling yourself what to do, and you're trying to drive towards the larger goals of the company that you work for, or the team that you're on, or whatever it is. And the onus is really on you to figure it out. At my company, what we've been doing, which I think really helps me structure my day a lot, is we have a call every morning at 10 a.m. for about 30 minutes, and then again at 4 p.m. for 30 minutes. And a lot of it is really just a mental health check-in to just make sure that like everybody has everything they need and people are feeling okay about everything that's going on. And, you know, we're not a super big team. Obviously, I work at a startup, so, you know, it's really easy to get 30 people on the phone a couple times a day and just kind of chat through the things that people might need in order to help get things done. But it requires you to actually share what you're working on. Ooh, I need this from this person. Or, you know, this is taking a lot longer than I thought because the client is doing XYZ in their own work from home phase. So that would be my biggest piece of advice with working from home is, one, like, try to structure your day. And two, try to get like one or two big things done a day. I think the reality is, especially when you're working from home and you really have to rely on so many forms of communication, whether you're emailing people, you're Slacking people, you're calling people, you're texting people, you know, you're really in your own little world. And a lot of it is reliant on your communication skills. So you're not going to get everything done that you want to every single day. And I do find with working from home, like things do take a little bit longer than they might in an office, where if you're just walking past somebody, you're able to go right up to somebody and just ask for something. It doesn't happen that way, obviously, working from home. But I do find that like you can be productive to really do the projects that you've been holding off on doing for a while, the things that you never get around to in the office. So working from home, I think, is really interesting. And it's also really good to like take care of yourself in that moment. Like take a 30-minute lunch break. Sit down and have a lunch. And if you're working from home with somebody else, like have lunch together. The same way you would leave the office, go pick up a salad somewhere. Like treat the day like you would a normal day. My husband has been getting up every morning. I literally know exactly what time it is in my sleep based on his schedule, which actually really helps me to have a great schedule myself. But I hear him showering. He gets like showered and dressed and he does his hair and the whole nine for all these video conferences that he's on. And honestly, I would do the same, except I just really so haven't been feeling well that it's really hard for me to, you know, want to brush my hair in between puking. But I do recommend that you do that and just sit and make yourself more of a formal desk area, right? Like get a glass of water, maybe make a tea or make a coffee. You got your headphones there. You got a notebook. You know, like get prepared and sit down like you would at your own desk. It also makes it fun. It makes it enjoyable. And I find that, you know, the days really just fly by when you're on like meeting to meeting, call to call. And by the way, that's all there is to do when you're working from home, because you have to be in touch with people way more often just to get more information out of them. So working from home is a really interesting thing. I feel like it's working really well for me right now, just given like how I'm feeling. And also we don't have another choice. But I think there's a lot of good things that you can take from it. And it also really just helps kind of like slow down the pace of everything going on in the workplace. I feel like people work on the things that they know they really need to get done. And I think that's why people feel like it is more efficient, because you're not doing, you know, random things in the office that you're getting pulled into, or, hey, you want to join this meeting or whatever it is. It's like you just have to get done what you need to get done. And then you obviously have the time and the space to do it from home. So working from home is obviously like ongoing. I think it's really crazy how the entire world is really like trying to find a way to do remote work. And I do wonder like what's going to happen when the world goes back to normal and how differently people will feel about working from home. Like I wonder if we'll see more people working from home or people taking like a couple days a week. In some jobs that I've had, like I've known people to like work from home on Fridays, especially if they had kids. And the other funny thing about working from home is that, you know, I mentioned on my podcast a couple weeks ago that my husband works from home part-time. Half the time he goes and sees clients and the other time he's at home. And obviously he's not going to see clients right now, but he has a very like structured way of working from home. And I always knew that he did, but now that I see it in action, it just like blows my mind. He's on calls all day. He paces around the house. He makes himself breakfast, lunch, and dinner. He has a full setup, and it actually works really well for us because I feel like I take the bedroom during the day, he takes the living room, and we never see each other. I obviously occasionally come out and I go into the kitchen and I get a water or I make a lunch and I have a snack. And, you know, we're always kind of like two ships passing in the night, because like he'll pop his head in here and I'll be on a call and I'll pop my head out there and he'll be on a call. And it's actually working really well for our marriage right now, because I feel like I don't see him all day. We don't really talk all day. I text him the same way I would text him if I was at work. And then we have dinner together at night. And it's been really interesting for me to see him working from home and be in his routine and do his thing. Like, so he loves working from home and he's super productive. Obviously he's very busy. I've been really busy too. And I think just like having your own space and making the most of that space and routinizing, I don't think that's a word, but I'm making it up, making a routine out of your day. Sometimes that can start with a workout in the morning. It can certainly start with a cup of coffee. It can start with a hairbrush. It can start with just getting your own little mental health right and doing a small little meditation, just something that makes you feel like you are starting your day on the right foot. The one thing I've been doing every single day when I wake up is the first thing I do is open the window. It's super weird, but I love the fresh air. It's dead silent here in New York City, and it just like blows some fresh air in, make the bed. And usually I'm running to grab some seltzer or some saltines and make a tea, but I set up my little area. And then the first thing that I really start doing is cleaning out my email before this 10 a.m. call that I have every day. And it just gets me in the groove. And sometimes I pick up my head and I can't believe it's like 2-3 o'clock. Where did the day go? Then I have this 4 o'clock call. And one of my coworkers actually did something genius. She sent a note around to a couple of us on the team. And she's like, I want to start doing like a daily check-in. And just for my own sanity and just to check in on you, you check in on me, see how I'm doing, see how you're doing. And I also feel like, yes, I have a 10 o'clock call and a 4 o'clock call every day, and those are business calls. But you could have a 10 o'clock call every day with your sibling, your mom, your grandma, you know, whoever it is, like somebody that is not work related, and just like have a check-in every day. Hi, good morning, how are you? I have a busy day at work. I'm looking forward to the day that we can all leave the house. Hope you have a great day. And honestly, I think it just like, I have always been like a very routine driven person in the sense that, you know, I would wake up every day, get dressed. I always went to Starbucks, got my coffee the exact same way, went to work, usually always around the same time. Work until the same time, come home, make dinner. Like, yes, not everything in that routine was always exactly the same, but I felt like I was just like more of a routine type person because like the way that I do things and the way that I, you know, live my life was on a little bit of a routine. And I feel like I'm going to take even some more routine-esque things with me, you know, outside of self-quarantining times and like add more things into my routine because I feel like it just really kind of like helps really ground and center the day. And I know that people do this thing on their calendar. They like time block. And so like they'll like block out an hour to like get work done, or they'll block out an hour to read up on something or to listen to a podcast or something of that sort. And my day is always just like too fickle with like calls and meetings and whatnot that I could never like block out a time that I would actually stick to. But I feel like I could either try to like wake up earlier and just like have more time for myself, or do like more at night. And just like, you know, what I'm really admiring is like my sister Jackie is like taking on reading, and like she like really makes time to like read all these books. The one thing I only make time for right now is like watching TV shows, but I feel like I want to even make more time to like do more productive things, especially as my time is going to become less and less my own. So that's topic number one. Obviously, it's ongoing, but making the most of your day with a routine, I think, is really helpful. And then also making sure that you hone the communication skills that you may or may not need during this quarantine time. I mean, that is the only way that working from home is successful, is if you are a good communicator. So if that hasn't been a skill set for you, this is a perfect time to work on it. And if it is a skill set for you, which I think it is for me, like it actually just makes the day go by so much faster. So it's totally like a win-win. Topic number two is also like in the theme of quarantine, because honestly, there's not that much else going on. So I can't think of anything other than like what my brain thinks about during quarantine. But this might be like moderately controversial. I just can't believe that I have been quarantining without a glass of wine. And I feel like for those of you who know me, know that like I take my wine drinking so seriously. And, you know, Zach and I went to Napa and we became super knowledgeable on everything Cabernet Sauvignon. Then, of course, we went to Italy where we got pregnant and we drank our little heart's content. And Zach has been a really good team player and just like not drinking while I can't drink, which I told him he could, of course, but like, I just don't think it's fun for him if we're like not, you know, like enjoying the bottle together. And I just see everybody on social media, like really kind of like ending off their days with some wine and people doing Zoom happy hours and all these fun things. And it's great. Like, I'll show up to your Zoom happy hour with my seltzer, but like, I don't want to be drinking my seltzer. Like, I really do miss kind of just like that relaxing end of the day wine with my husband, or maybe with some dinner, trying and testing good wine. And I feel like, is it shameful to say that I miss wine? I mean, I'll also say, like, I kind of miss hot dogs. I thought about it the other day, like, I really wanted a hot dog. And I'm like, well, obviously I can't have one. So, like, I'm looking forward to having a hot dog. But I feel like there's not the same level of stigma where it's like, I miss a hot dog. It's like, I miss a glass of wine. And I think it's, like, okay to say that you miss alcohol because, you know, it was, at least for me, like, a big part of, like, my social life. But then I guess I just realized I don't really even have a social life right now. I haven't had a social life for like a while because I just am so tired. I don't even want to leave the house most of the time now that I can leave the house now. And so I'm just like, kind of, maybe it's like I'm just lusting for the things that I can't have now. And obviously kind of we're getting there in the third trimester. And I'm kind of really realizing like it's been a while without spicy tuna. Even with like deli turkey, like it's not even something that I eat every day. It's just like these things that you can't have. I feel like it makes me miss them. The one thing I will say that I don't miss, though, is I'm not really missing coffee. It's just so weird. Like, I just feel like I used to wake up every day and I, like, had to go get my Starbucks the exact same way that I've drank it every single day for the last, like, 10 plus years. And the second I stopped drinking coffee, I really, like, I didn't want for it anymore. I think I just knew that, like, I was going to be tired regardless. Like, the caffeine wasn't necessarily going to help me. But I've really cut back on like everything that is kind of not everything that you're not supposed to have. I just don't have because why not? But also like things like Diet Coke. And, you know, obviously you can have it. I asked my doctor about it and she was just like, I just don't understand people who drink things with like fake sugar regardless. Like fake sugar isn't so great for you. You should just try to have like more natural things. But like I miss Diet Coke and I probably have like one Diet Coke like every 7 weeks, if that. Like it's like if I really, really want one, then I'll have it. But that's something I miss. Coffee, I don't know. I'm just like not missing Starbucks. One time I actually got a coffee before Claudia's Beacon show. I just like wanted to be awake. I wanted to like go to the after party. I really wanted to like show the fuck up. I took 3 sips of it. I was like, I don't want this. Like I don't like this taste and I don't want any of this. And it's weird. I guess like with some things, like when you eat them during your pregnancy, a lot of people say like, I survived on blah and like, I can't even look at it anymore. And I will say like, I haven't survived on wine. So it's like, I'm going to be real ready to look at it the second that I can. But I don't know if there's going to be anything that like, I don't want anymore. It's just more so I kind of miss the things that I can't have. Because I just think the only thing that we have in these quarantine times is like food and drink. So it's like, and then if there are specific food and drink that you can't have, it just kind of makes you want them more. Maybe it's just me. I don't know. I want a hot dog, okay? And I told Zach that the other night that, you know, in a couple months, just want a big juicy hot dog with some sauerkraut and good mustard and a nice pillowy dough. And I'll probably wash it down with a glass of wine. And honestly, it will be a really happy day for me. Okay, last topic before we get into our guest today is a fun one because a lot of you have reached out to me, whether DM, email, otherwise. And sometimes you share topics that you want me to cover. Sometimes you share questions, you share advice. And I'm loving hearing from everybody. And it's just so much fun. But one of my listeners sent an amazing question, and I just wanted to treat it as topic 3 because I feel like I could obviously talk about this all day. She said, brief background, I'm 26. I have a solid group of like 5 girlfriends, all of us being between 25 and 27 years old, where we've all been best friends since middle school. At this point, we've beaten the odds. I know these are my girlfriends I want for life. And after we've all ventured off to different colleges, but always stayed close, and now post-grad, we're all just closer than ever. Being in our mid-20s, 2 of the girls in the group are now becoming moms. I could not be happier. I love all things baby-related, and I myself can't wait to be a mom one day. Sounds like a great friend. First episode, you talked a lot about friendships and only spending your energy on people who really deserve it and will actually be in the next phase of your life with you. So, here's my question. With 2 of my best friends entering a new chapter of their lives now, how do I evolve with them and stay the good friend that they need? Like, what exactly is a mom or a pregnant person looking for in a friend now? We're all very inquisitive about each other's lives, but are our questions about everything annoying? Then if we talk about other topics too much, is it rude that we're not making everything about their pregnancy? How do I make sure that just because they're transitioning to parenthood before the rest of us, that they know we're still there for them just as much? When they're struggling, do I just listen, or what are the right words I'm supposed to say? Luckily, our friendships don't solely revolve around alcohol and bars, so them not drinking doesn't really throw a wrench in any plans or dynamics. I fully acknowledge that I can't relate to the morning sickness, the body changes, the anxiety of parenthood, and the hormone changes, but these are my best friends. I would be so interested in hearing your thoughts on the topic. Okay, these are my thoughts on the topic. Number one, it just goes without saying that even that you took the time to write this note is like, you are a good friend, and like, you would not be the type of person to disappoint your friends. Number two, pregnant people are not looking for everything to be made about them. What I find in my pregnancy is sometimes you just want to vent, and sometimes you just want to be able to complain, and you just want to be able to say, oh my God, the morning sickness. Oh my God, the body changes. Oh my God, my hormones. And you want to have someone on the other end that just like, accepts that you want to complain and not tries to glorify everything. Like, but it's all for a good reason. You know, of course it's for a good reason, but that doesn't change the fact that sometimes you just want to fucking complain about it. Like, that's what I feel for me is like, sometimes I just need somebody to, I need to be able to safe cry. And I need the person on the other end to just like, literally just be there for me to cry and to vent to, and not try to make excuses for like everything that's happening. Cause like, I know why it's happening, and it is a blessing that it's happening, and it's wonderful. But the fact is like, the only type of friends that I feel like pregnant people really need is just like a shoulder to cry on and someone to vent to. Just listen a little bit more. Like, they'll just need to know that, like, I have this safe place of, like, if I'm not feeling well today or if I'm struggling with something, then I can say something to so-and-so, and it's, like, a judgment-free zone, and the response that I get back from them isn't going to be a fucking eye roll. And that is something, at least, that I would recommend to you, of just, like, if you're really concerned with being a good friend, which you obviously are, so thus you're obviously a good friend, like, just be there. Let them say whatever they want to say. And it seems like you are a good friend in the sense that you guys obviously inquire about each other's lives and just say like, how are you doing today? How are you feeling? Is there anything I can get to you? Just put it out there. Just know that this person has you for all of the things that are happening that are up, down. Because you know what? Sometimes you don't want to always talk to your husband about the body changes or the hormone changes. You know, sometimes you just want to talk to a friend. And you don't necessarily, you don't need the friend to come back at you with all of the things, all the reasons why they think your hormones are changing and how they're, here, try this for morning sickness or this, I know someone that did this and it really worked for them. You know, sometimes you just need someone to say, oh, that sucks, I'm so sorry you're going through that. To me, I think that that is the best possible friend that you can be, is to just say, I'm so sorry that you're going through that, I'm here for you if you need anything. Because I think the other thing too is, you're going to need that from your friends who have been through it too. And maybe by the time that they've gone through it, they will actually have advice to give to you when it is your turn. But right now, no one expects anything from you because you haven't gone through pregnancy. They just need that shoulder. They just need that support system. They can Google a zillion things and they can talk to their doctor and they can talk to their friends who have been pregnant to get advice. What they need from you is just a safe place to vent. And honestly, I think that goes for all friendships. Like, sometimes you just need someone to go to in a judgment-free zone and say what it is that you have to say and just know that the person on the other end isn't going to come back at you with like a zillion things that you could be, should be doing better, could be doing differently. Next time, try this. It's just like, ugh, I'm so sorry. That stinks. I'm here for you if you need anything. That is the best piece of advice that I can give anybody on friendships. It's just like, be there. Nobody expects you to go above and beyond or have all the answers or, you know, be a whole book of advice. They just need you to just be a person that's there, that like, it's a safe place that every time somebody has something that they want to vent about, you're a good venter to her. And that's the big three for you. But you know, this podcast is not anywhere near done because it is now time for my guest segment. I am super excited to welcome Dr. Christine Sterling to Maternity Live. Dr. Christine Sterling, you are
a board certified OBGYN. You just recently had your second child.
Yes.
Your husband is an emergency physician.
Yeah.
Like, how do you do it all?
Well, the truth is I don't. I think that the idea that you can do it all is, it's a fallacy. So I did, so when I first had my daughter in 2017, I was working full-time as an OBGYN. And full-time as an OBGYN oftentimes means 50 to 60 hours a week. And I went back from maternity leave. I had 12 weeks of maternity leave. I went back, I think I did that for a month and was like, yeah, no, it's not possible. And so then I went down to part-time, which was 40 hours a week. And, you know, I went through a big transition in my career when I had my daughter, when I realized that, you know, really we had a beautiful opportunity in prenatal care to really help prepare people for the parenthood transition and for what it's like to actually go through postpartum in the fourth trimester and all of that. And it just wasn't really happening. So I did try for about another year and a half to kind of integrate that into my practice. But you know, our appointments are about 10 minutes. And there's only one postpartum appointment, at least the majority of, that's how the majority of offices are set up. And I felt very strongly that moms, new families deserve more education and more explanation and just more support through that entire journey. And really, midwives who take like standard insurance and OBGYNs and family practice doctors that are seeing pregnant women, when you are taking insurance, you're limited to very short appointments. And there's a real deficit of education for the entire reproductive journey. It just cannot be shoved into those appointments. And so I made the career transition to go completely online. So delivered my last baby and saw my last patient in September, and then dedicated until the release of my postpartum online course in January. That's all I did, was just create an online course with a marriage and family therapist to prepare people for postpartum. So I don't do it all. You know, I couldn't continue to practice clinically and make all the videos I make and do all the posts and do all of that stuff. I couldn't. It's too hard. So I have a lot of help. I have a very involved husband, and I have a mom who lives with us part-time. So don't think I do it all.
Amazing. Well, it's funny because obviously I'm entering my third trimester, and I've talked a lot, like from my own vantage point, just around like, I don't really know the best places to get information, because I just feel like there is so much information. Yeah. And I feel like, you know, immediately with you, it's like, not only have you been through it yourself now twice, but obviously you're also, you know, you went to school for this. And so you really understand, and you've seen, you know, from my vantage point, I can read anything online about, you know, what type of delivery I could have, or all the different right. ways that you, you know, could get induced, or, you know, C-section or whatnot. And then it's like, here you have delivered probably hundreds of children. And it's like, yeah. There's no better person to get that information from. Cause you're right. When you go to the doctor, you have 10 minutes in the room. I sit yeah. there. I craft my list of questions. I don't even get through half of them by the time the appointment.
Of course you don't.
And sometimes it's like, some days I care more about things than other days.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I really do think that you need that level of expertise. And in the absence, you know, and rightfully so, because people are craving this information, people have flooded into the motherhood space to provide that guidance. But the reality is that, you know, even doulas who are, you know, see, you know, not as many as maybe I've seen, but they see a lot of birth, but they obviously see it from one vantage point, right? And truth be told, when you're an OBGYN who also has their own pregnancy journey, and you can, and especially if you're an open-minded OBGYN, you can see it from all the different angles. You know, you can take off your doctor hat and put on your mom hat. And I really think that that's what women deserve. And so, you know, in a vacuum, yeah, you've got mommy bloggers giving advice. You have doulas who in some circumstances are talking with expertise, but there's certainly, they can't talk with expertise about a C-section, right? They've never done one. So I really want to provide that expertise with a heart to people and kind of humanize all of us in healthcare. I think what we're seeing right now with the pandemic is humanizing healthcare providers. And I think that's really, really, really important, because when we are put on a pedestal, both for our own sake and for the patient's sake, when we are put on a pedestal, it does not help either side. You know, people are afraid to talk to their doctor. People they don't realize how human we are, and to really just to see us as human is better. And we can talk more about like what I mean by that. But I think that that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to humanize OB providers for everyone and really share my expertise in a way that everybody can understand.
I love that. And I think that that's so important. And to your point, I think one of the things right now, especially for pregnant women, is so much with coronavirus is unknown. Yeah. Obviously, yeah. This is like a whole new virus that has entered the world. And, you know, we're learning more and more every day in terms of how people are being affected by it, and especially how pregnant women are being affected by it. Yeah. What is your take on how coronavirus is affecting pregnant women? And is it affecting, you know, the fetus in utero? Is it not? Can babies get it? All the questions.
Okay, well, so let's start off with a very easy answer. Babies in general, yes, can get it. I know that there's been a lot of talk about kids are doing much better, and thank goodness for that. But when we look at, you know, babies less than 12 months, we can't be as confident that they're going to be just fine. And newborns, we cannot be just as confident that they're going to be just fine. We do not know. And so in the absence of data, we just have to proceed with abundance of caution. Now, initially, I don't know, this was probably 2 weeks ago, we were thinking that vertical transmission, and that means mom gets a virus or another illness, and it transmits through the placenta to the baby. We thought that based on the data from Wuhan, that it didn't look like vertical transmission was happening. Now we are finding some evidence that vertical transmission may happen. But the question is that transmission clinically significant? So for example, if you're pregnant and you get the flu, the regular influenza, as long as you do okay, like you don't end up in the ICU on a respirator or on a ventilator, your baby's going to be okay. So is coronavirus like that? Like as long as mom does okay, then baby will be okay too? Or is it going to be something like, the reason why pregnant women are supposed to stay away from like deli meats and all that stuff is Listeria. Is it going to be something like Listeria, which is a bacteria? It's not a virus. It's different, but where that can severely affect the pregnancy, even if mom looks okay. So we just do not know. The reality is that pregnant women are slightly what we call immunocompromised, which means their immune system is a little bit dampened, because obviously you have a foreign person living inside of you. You do not want your own immune system to attack your baby. So we are considered a little immune compromised when we're pregnant. So that means that we may be more likely to get coronavirus if we're exposed to it, though we don't know that for certain. We also know that pregnant women are, because there's a lot of changes that happen to our cardiovascular system in pregnancy, we know that with other viral illnesses, we are more prone to having more severe respiratory symptoms than a non-pregnant individual. We don't necessarily know that's the case with coronavirus, but most of us are assuming that that's what we're going to end up seeing, because we've seen it with pretty much every other virus. So it's not something that should be taken lightly. My hunch is that hopefully coronavirus is going to be very similar to influenza, in that vertical transmission isn't going to cause like, you know, it's not going to be like Zika where you have, you know, congenital malformations or something from it. I very much hope that's the case. We can't say that right now, but that's my hope.
So interesting. And thank you for sharing that. So one quick question I have with that is, obviously different people are experiencing coronavirus differently. So we've heard everything that's like, you know, shortness of breath, which typically, and from what I've read online, and obviously you can either debunk this or, you know, say that it's true, but shortness of breath can be a symptom in pregnancy as well, just because everything is changing and growing. And then you have like things like loss of smell and loss of taste that people are now talking about. And so are we seeing specific symptoms with women who are testing positive for coronavirus, or everybody's case is just unique to them?
So, and again, we don't have large volumes of data. It's sometimes things can present differently in pregnancy than in a non-pregnant individual. We don't really know if there's like a classic presentation for a pregnant patient yet, but we can go over a few things. So one, shortness of breath. Yes, shortness of breath can be part of a normal pregnancy. And there's a few reasons for that. Number one, you can even start feeling a little short of breath, you know, at the beginning of your pregnancy, end of first trimester, beginning of second trimester. And that shortness of breath is typically because our respiratory rate, how often we're breathing in and out, goes up in pregnancy. And some people are really sensitive to that. I can remember with my first pregnancy, when I was noticing that I was breathing a little bit faster, it's not true shortness of breath, but it was definitely a little uncomfortable for me. So there's that, you know, there's that symptom. And then as our bellies grow and the uterus gets closer and closer to our diaphragm, our actual like lung volumes are smaller. And so our body is making up for that by breathing a little bit faster. But yeah, when you go up a flight of stairs, when you're pregnant versus not pregnant, it feels different, right? So some of the things that, and this is in general, this is not specific to coronavirus, but some of the kind of things that I tell people to be on the lookout for, like red flags of shortness of breath, is a change from your baseline. You know, things in pregnancy, usually it may progressively slowly, your shortness of breath may get a little bit more noticeable, but it's not usually an overnight thing. So something that changes really quickly, if it's associated with chest pain, cough, palpitations, which is like the feeling like your heart is beating irregularly. And if you know, it's normal to walk up a flight of stairs and feel a little short of breath, but you should sit down and it should get better, right? If your shortness of breath isn't improving as you change your activity level, that's another red flag. And that those aren't perfect guidelines, but they're something. Because yes, shortness of breath can be a symptom of coronavirus, as can be basically, you know, all of your common like flu-like symptoms and, you know, cold-like symptoms. So it's, and yes, some people have very mild symptoms or completely asymptomatic, and other people, even some people who are young and healthy, are ending up in critical condition. And we do not, other than age, pre-existing conditions, why does one young person get very sick and the other person doesn't? If they're all else is equal, we don't really know.
Makes sense. And so when you were talking about babies getting it,
obviously
there's a chance that they can get it during delivery, just in the hospital.
Yep.
But then also, are children symptomatic, or are they not really as affected by it the same way a newborn, probably less than a year old, could be?
Yeah, so they are. And, you know, I'm not a pediatrician, so I'm not reading their data as much. And really, it seems like the world isn't really focusing on the kids, because they are not like, you know, the children's hospitals are not filling up needing ventilators.
Right.
Immunocompromised children with pre-existing medical conditions are always going to be more susceptible. But in general, the kids seem to be not needing to be hospitalized at the same rate as adults, and having milder symptoms. But you know, we have to, I think one of the things that's been a little bit frustrating for me in watching the coverage is how often everybody's saying, you know, this is really about the elderly and those with pre-existing medical conditions, but we're seeing a fair amount of healthy people. You know, they're in their 30s, they're in their 40s, and they're in the ICU, or they unfortunately have succumbed to COVID-19. And so I don't want any of us to just say, oh, I've had followers who have sent me messages and saying that they're being criticized by their friends and family for keeping their kids indoors, and they're being told kids can't get it and you don't need to be so worried about your kids. And that really freaks me out. We need to assume that, you know, that everybody could potentially have a severe case. And that's not to, you know, that's really scary to hear as a parent. I get it. Like, but I don't want people to be overly anxious, but I also want them to not be complacent and think that just because they have a 4-year-old that they don't need to be social distancing because they're going to be just fine, if that makes sense.
No, totally. I think that's part of it is like, I'm with you. Like, I don't, you know, preach for any additional anxiety during this time, just because I think like pregnancy can be very anxiety riven.
It's enough.
But the reality is like, I think some people feel like maybe are they being like too extreme in wanting to, you know, keep themselves distanced from even just other family members or, you know, colleagues, if people are essential workers and still have to leave the house. So it's like, if you are a pregnant person, like, do you think that you should just stay inside and, you know, not really come into contact with as many people as you can?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Yeah. I mean, listen, it's tough. Like, my husband and I have had to have some difficult conversations. Obviously, he's on the front lines. And there are some people, some healthcare workers that are separating from their family. And there are, you know, I have a OBGYN colleague who is pregnant, and her husband is an emergency medicine physician, and she has, they're separating. Not in terms of their marriage.
Yes, but physically.
But, and so, you know, my husband and I had to sit down and say, is this something we need to do? And, you know, we had to look at it for us, and you know, my husband and my daughter are very, very, very close. And I worry about the trauma to her if her dad was to not be around. And so we are doing, you know, he is being extremely careful at work. Fortunately, they do not have as much protective gear as they truly need, but they are not in the situation that a lot of my friends are in. So I feel like he has a really good shot of not contracting COVID-19. And then he's very careful at home. He's, you know, trying to kind of keep his distance from them. He's showering immediately upon getting home. He's changing out of his clothes before he gets home. You know, so you have to take measures that you feel comfortable with and that are reasonable to you. And that's a person to person decision. You know, if you want to separate, you know, we're not coming in contact with any other people. We had our housekeeper, we gave her, you know, 6 weeks pay, and we said, enjoy your time off. Yeah. Because, you know, we don't want to bring another source of potential. We are already kind of have a vulnerable spot with my husband being on the front lines.
Right.
Don't want any more vulnerable spots. And we do not want to expose anyone else, because that would just be, that would be heartbreaking, you know, to potentially get someone else sick. So we are not having contact with anyone. So I have a newborn baby who has not met the majority of my family.
Yeah.
That sucks, but, you know, taking pictures, sending pictures, that kind of stuff. And it's sad, but these are unprecedented times. So you suck it up for the good of humanity, you know?
Totally. 100%. I want to pivot away from COVID just for a second, because obviously, you know, there are also happy times, and obviously being an OBGYN and bringing so many wonderful babies into this world is probably like so rewarding and also just wonderful. So thank you for going into this profession and doing that for all of us who need you so desperately. But A lot of people ask me questions just around things that people can do even prior to getting pregnant, or things that even just help with getting pregnant in general. And so, you know, obviously you talk a lot about the fourth trimester, which I'd love to get to as well, just around postpartum. But what about like even like the pre-trimester? Like, what are some recommendations that you have for people even prior to getting pregnant? Are there certain, you know, prenatals or vitamins that they should be taking? Is there a certain way that they should think about, you know, people talk about like going and, you know, getting their health and diet and exercise in check. Yeah. So what recommendations do you have on that front?
How much time do you have? Essentially, the way that I break it down is into body, mind, and heart. I think the really important thing to realize is that, you know, when we think about getting pregnant, we're oftentimes thinking about it from a physical standpoint. And yes, pregnancy is a physical experience, but it is also a emotional, mental experience, and it's also an experience for a couple, if you're in a partnered relationship, for a family, it's a transition, right? So I like to take a really holistic approach in terms of preparing for pregnancy. And so from a physical standpoint, one of the most important things that, you know, I tell people to do, and obviously this is not going to be happening right now, but is to do a preconception visit with an OBGYN or a midwife. And basically at this visit, what we're looking for is any medical history, surgical history that could potentially make it, you know, either more difficult to get pregnant, put your pregnancy at a higher risk, or potentially be something that we need to be looking for, like a hereditary condition that we should be looking for in your offspring. And so really a thorough review of your medical history, of your surgical history, looking at your medications. A lot of people will, you know, say, oh, you know, I'm going to get pregnant. I'm on Zoloft, but I'm just going to stop. And we really don't want people to stop medications without a plan, without talking to their physician. So looking at your medications and seeing which ones could be altered or changed, which ones need to be discontinued, having a plan for that is really important. And then talking about genetic testing. So one thing that we offer to anybody, or should be offered to anybody who comes in for a preconception consultation, is to say, hey, you know, do you want to look and see if you are a carrier of any recessive diseases? So like cystic fibrosis, for example. So that you can make reproductive decisions having all of the information. Some people want to do that and some people don't, but everybody should at least have the opportunity to talk about that option. And then also to go over things like, to weight and exercise and all of that. I think weight is a really tricky, discussion to have. You know, weight loss can help some people get pregnant, and it can help lower your risk in pregnancy. We know that with many conditions, the risk goes up as your body mass index gets into different categories. And so that's something to talk about. I think it's really important that when we talk about weight, we also realize that there is an emotional component to any discussion about weight. And so we have to also address, you know, we have to address that as well. So if you have a history of an eating disorder, or you have a poor body image, these are things that, while your OBGYN might not have the answer for you at that appointment, you need to be encouraged to explore that, because we know that poor body image, we know that people with a history of an eating disorder have a higher risk of postpartum depression. And really the time to deal with that is before and during pregnancy, not in the postpartum period. So there's a whole holistic way that we can approach preparing for pregnancy. That's not just about, oh, I need to get in shape because I'm going to get pregnant, I need to take a prenatal vitamin. It's really, I'm going on this reproductive journey, and it may end in a live child, in which, you know, that's a huge adjustment to your family, to your relationship, to you, your identity, but also it can end, you know, you could be, then you could be dealing with infertility, or you could be dealing with pregnancy loss. So you never know what the outcome's going to be. So I take a pretty holistic approach to preparing people for that phase of their lives.
And then what about on the postpartum side, which is obviously like something that you talk a lot about. And I would imagine that especially during these like self-quarantining times, if you have postpartum depression, or if you're really struggling in the postpartum phase and you are like alone by yourself in your house, you are probably really struggling. And so like, how are you advising anybody that's coming to you with those anxieties, just like in this kind of purgatory phase of the unknown in terms of when it's going to end and when life is going to go back to normal?
Yeah. In a way, I feel like everybody in the world now who's quarantining is kind of having a postpartum experience to some
extent. It's true.
This is, you know, but this is obviously very, very extreme that we can't even have visitors and our normal support system. So what I usually tell people who are having a difficult time either with postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety is the thing that they can do right away is to get restorative sleep. That is incredibly important when we look at postpartum depression and anxiety. And in fact, the symptoms of depression mirror those of sleep deprivation. So if you are sleep deprived, you are far more likely to be depressed. And in even depression is going to change your sleep patterns. So sometimes we need to figure out, is this just somebody who's severely, severely sleep deprived, or is this someone who's truly has postpartum depression? So, I tell people you need, you know, ideally 6 hours, but in the 4 to 6 hour range of uninterrupted sleep. If you're already getting 4 hours of uninterrupted sleep, try to do 6, try to do 8. And at this point, if you think that you're experiencing depression or anxiety, breastfeeding comes second. I know that that's hard for some people to hear, and that's not necessarily what the generally people seem to put breastfeeding above everything else. But if you think, you know what, I think I'm depressed, I think that I'm dealing with postpartum anxiety, your breastfeeding journey is important, but that is more important. And I think that, you know, even the data will support that, because the data on, for example, you know, we hear all the time, oh, breastfed babies have higher IQs. And that's actually not, that's based on one study, and the problem is they didn't control for moms' college education and their education level. So moms who were college educated were more likely to be breastfeeding. So that data is muddy. But what we do know is that moms who or parents who have untreated postpartum depression, that their children have measurable cognitive delays. And so we need to put mom, dad's mental health above breastfeeding when we come to a situation where we're worried about postpartum depression or anxiety. So number one, get restorative sleep. And if that means you have to supplement, do it. If that means you have to pump in preparation, do it. If you have to, you know, you can ask a partner. I know we're in social distancing, so we can't necessarily have a friend or a family member who is not quarantining with us come over. That's usually part of my advice. If you have a partner who's working and can't do it, phone a friend or phone a family member, but that's, you know, times are different now. So it may be just a matter of pumping or supplementing to get that sleep. So that's the first thing that I tell people that they need to do. And then the second thing is to seek help. And that is different for everyone. So for some people, it will be enough to go to their close friends and family and to tell them what they're feeling. And that might be enough. A lot of postpartum depression anxiety comes down to shame. It comes down to this idea that I should be enjoying this. Because I'm not enjoying this, there's something wrong with me. I'm not doing a good enough job as a mom or as a parent. And then we get into a shame spiral. We're sleep deprived. We're feeling unsure. And then we end up depressed. So sometimes just talking to some friends and family and having them be like, oh yeah, I had postpartum depression too. This is what I did. It can relieve some of that shame, because shame cannot exist with light. When we're open about how we're feeling, we can't be ashamed about it. And then professional help, I would, you know, the is really important. There's teletherapy that's available now. Online support groups can be very helpful, you know, and then if need be, medication. And that's something that can also be prescribed over telemedicine. So if you have a, you can have a phone call with your provider and they can prescribe you medication if that's what it comes down to. But first is sleep. Second is talking to someone. And third is, calling in the professionals. And even if you don't want to go on medication, even if you don't feel like you need therapy, telling your OB provider is really important so they can keep tabs on you.
So can I ask one question around that? Because obviously last week there was a lot of ruckus, and I personally was very upset that some New York City hospitals were, you know, banning support partners in the delivery room, just given everything going on. The governor since overturned it. And one of the things that I was talking about or even thinking about as it relates to that is how much of postpartum depression and anxiety can actually come from a traumatizing delivery.
Yeah, so definitely that's a risk factor. About 30% of people will describe their birth as being traumatic, where about like 4 to 9% will develop two post-traumatic stress disorder as a result. In some situations, there's the majority of people who have a traumatizing birth experience also have, you know, weren't giving birth alone. They still had a support person.
Right.
But would being, you know, without a support person, would that increase the risk of having a traumatizing experience? That is possible. We don't know that because obviously we've never done this before. We've never limited like to this extent visitors in labor and delivery. But I would suspect that you could probably, that there would be an additional fear. I think and I know New York has gone back on this. I think across the country that this may still pop up in the hot zones. So it's not totally gone. I think the thing that many people, especially if they haven't had a baby before, don't realize is how, and this is it for, you know, 98, 99% of people, how involved your labor and delivery nurse is with you. I hear a lot of people saying, oh, nurses are already spread so thin, but really labor and delivery, like if you have a patient who's pushing, that's your only patient. You're not bouncing in between patients from a nursing standpoint. So the nurses are very involved. And I would say probably 50-50, and this is completely anecdotal just based on my experience. Most partners who are there, are giving less emotional support than the labor and delivery nurses because they are in a very unfamiliar situation themselves. They don't necessarily know what's going on. And so they can try to reassure mom, the birthing person, but they don't necessarily know what's going on. And when you're when you are unsure, you want someone to give you answers. And so you see labor and delivery nurses as, if anybody is listening and is going to be in a situation where they are birthing without a support person, I just don't want them to be terrified that they're going to be alone, because I don't think you'll ever be truly alone. You will have nurses and OBGYNs in hospitals that have put these restrictions in place are truly heartbroken for their patients and are very worried about the impact on their patients.
I think that's very comforting actually, because I, to your point, like I'm somebody that is obviously, this is my first go around. Yeah. And when I heard that news, I like immediately jumped to the fact that like, you know, you feel like you're going to be alone. You feel like, you know, the nurse is probably just in and out the same way. The doctor's just in and out, and there's a million other things going on. But I think it's actually really comforting to hear that that's not necessarily the case. And until you actually experience it, and know like that there's people that are in the room that really can provide both emotional and then obviously both physical support. I think that you hear one thing once, like nurses are in and out, and then you just assume that in your head. And you don't believe it until you actually see it.
Listen, I'll tell you something, and this, I'll tell my husband not to, I won't encourage my husband to listen to this. Truth be told, and granted, I'm different than your average person giving birth, because I'm an OB-GYN, right? But truth be told, if I had to pick having my husband there or having like a rock star labor and delivery nurse, in terms of how I felt, not thinking about him and him experiencing the birth of his child, which obviously is important to me as well, but just thinking about my personal experience, I would choose a rock star labor and delivery nurse any day over my husband.
Really?
Oh, for sure.
Okay. That listen. So that's very like interesting information, because I feel like I have just like, especially when I heard this news, I was even on the war path that I was like, you need someone's hand to hold and someone to yell at and, you know, someone to just, you know, have there for the experience too. But to that point, like, you're right. Like, they haven't experienced it yet. So how really helpful can they be?
A lot of dads are super, and you know, dads or birthing partners or support people they're uncomfortable in the hospital setting, you know? And so they're unsure. They'll look at me and they'll be like, oh, can I hold her leg? And I'm like, dude, yeah, it's your person. Like, you don't have to ask my permission, you know? So they can be, you'll be surprised. Like you'll see a different side of your partner because they may be more timid than you're expecting them to be. I know a lot of moms will send me messages being like, I really want my husband to be my advocate at the hospital. I'm like, okay, is your husband or your partner, your wife, are they normally like, are they good at being an advocate in healthcare settings? And they're like, no. And I'm like, that you can't expect that from them.
Right.
Because you can try, but even, you know, even like my husband with my first delivery, I had somewhat of a traumatizing experience. And my husband knew a lot of my wishes. And at the end, my wishes, I hadn't vocalized them because I thought that I thought that they were a given because of the setting. I gave birth in a birth center inside of a labor and delivery in a hospital, and I had midwives. And so there were some things that I wanted to be done at the end that weren't done. And I know my husband knew that I had wanted those things, but he was so wrapped up in the experience that he, and kind of even as a healthcare person who's very comfortable in the setting, wasn't able to say, hey, and I had a doula there too, and wasn't able to say, hey, you know, I know Christine didn't really want to push, like have counted pushing and to push the baby out as fast as possible. I knew she wanted to like kind of slowly push and slowly crown to minimize tearing. Even though I had a doula and I had my husband there, you know, if I think that the people that would be, have been more important to communicate that to are the labor and delivery nurse and the midwife who was delivering me.
Interesting.
So I relied on that, the support system, and they didn't do that, you know?
Right. So let me ask you a question on that, because right now, like obviously I'm even just thinking from my own experience. So I hadn't done any birthing classes or Lamaze or anything of the like yet, just because they encourage you to do it closer to delivery, just so you retain all the information that you could possibly retain. Yeah. But obviously people aren't hanging around in hospitals anymore. So what do you recommend for women who are in their third trimester who like probably have not had the full experience of doing a birthing class, or like, are there online things that you recommend, or what's the best way for people to like get information? Should they try to spend more time with their own OBGYNs, or, you know, what is the best way? Even like for myself, like, I don't even know where to begin in terms of figuring out how to go about this now that I can't go to the hospital.
Totally. So in terms of, free resources, I have a bunch of, IGTV videos that walk people through a lot of different aspects of birth that is important, I think, for people to know. And these are things that are not even in, like, even if you had a labor class at your hospital, these are things that they don't talk about. So that's a really great free resource. My Instagram is just Dr. Sterling OBGYN. And then, you know, you click on the IGTV icon in my profile and there's like all of these videos. So that's a really great free resource. The in terms of online classes, the one that I actually decided to become an affiliate for and recommend is one that I think is really important for this time, is one that was created by another OBGYN who has a philosophy very similar to mine in terms of taking a holistic perspective. And the reason why I think a class taught by an OBGYN is so crucial at this time is because a lot of the classes, labor classes, will focus, and not all, but a lot of them will focus on a specific outcome. Like, I want an unmedicated birth that looks like this, right? And so they'll do all of that preparation. I took hypnobirthing with my first, as well. And I think I didn't realize that those birthing classes didn't prepare people for, well, what happens when things don't go according to plan? And that is where the trauma occurs. That is where people are going to be really freaked out when they don't have all of the support that they were expecting to have. And they don't feel as comfortable with all the different things that are going on in labor and delivery. And that, you know, what's a vacuum delivery? What is an episiotomy? Like, all of the things that, you know, can help you just wrap your brain around all the different ways that things can go. I think that kind of course is really, really crucial right now, because I worry that if we just focus on, oh, I just want this type of birth, you know, it very rarely goes that way. And I can say that from my own personal experience too. You know, I've had two birth experiences. The first one looked picture perfect. It was exactly, Olivia, if I could have, I mean, it would, everything I wanted to happen at the end really happened. I labored in a tub. There was spa music playing. The lights were dim, all of that. And that was actually a really traumatizing experience for me. And then my second, my water broke before I went into labor, ended up having to be induced. And I had an epidural, and those were all things that I did not want with my first. And my second birth was phenomenal.
Really?
It was like the most beautiful experience ever. And it was everything I didn't want, you know, and I got everything I wanted the first time. And so that's why I think it's so important to really not prepare for one type of birth, but just prepare for birth in its entirety, because it is so unpredictable.
Totally. Well, I think that's a perfect place to end, because I now have to go prepare for birth and for all the different births that could potentially happen, which I feel like, just as a human being, I'm like just a curious person. So I like to like get more information than I probably need. But it is true. It's like, you have absolutely no idea what kind of birth you're going to have. And like half the words you just said, I never heard them before. So like, I need to read up on potentially anything. So that way, like, when I'm in the room, and whatever the situation goes, I can like make an informed decision versus a decision being made on my behalf because I didn't have all the information.
And you know what? My best piece of advice for being in labor and having a decision and not knowing what to do is always tell your nurse and your OB provider how you are feeling. If you are scared, if you are unsure, if you just tell them, do not keep it to yourself, because we, you know, healthcare providers are called to the profession because we deeply care about people and we want to help people. And when you say to me, I'm scared, it's such a different, like, you're going to get me to roll, like pull up a chair, sit down with you, talk you through it and reassure you, because that's, but if I don't know that you're scared, I can't tell, because I don't know you well enough to pick up on your signs, you know. You don't need to do this alone. We are there to help. So just tell us how you're feeling.
Okay, will do. I'm definitely going to be scared. And I will definitely, I feel like that goes back to kind of like the shame thing, where it's like, you don't want to admit that you're scared. But I feel like having an OBG telling you to tell someone that you're scared, okay, I feel like I have free rein to do that now.
Please, please. I mean, there's nothing to be ashamed of, or there's no such thing as you're about to have a human being come out of your body one way or another.
Right.
Yeah. If that's Like, it is okay. I know everybody talks about no fear, no fear, don't be afraid, but that's just normal. That's human. Yeah. Humans have fear. And when we're afraid of it and we shove it down and we pretend like it's not there, I don't think we do ourselves any help. I think it's better to say, hey, I'm actually really scared right now. And just to acknowledge it. And it's okay. It's okay to be afraid. We can do things even though we are afraid.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally agree. Dr. Sterling, thank you so much for joining me on Maternity Live. Everybody should go follow Dr. Sterling at Dr. Sterling, OBGYN. Watch her IGTVs. Learn all of the different amazing tips and tricks and tactics that she has for every phase of pre-pregnancy, pregnancy, postpartum. Anything, anywhere else where people can locate you and get information from you, or is Instagram the best place?
Instagram's great. I also have a lot of resources, free resources on my website, which is thesterlinglife.com, where I have blog posts and I have workbooks and guides and all kinds of goodies.
Amazing. I have to get on that as well. And I have to get on all my, all the birthing classes that I need to get on. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. It was such an honor talking to you. I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing all of your sound and sage advice and wisdom with my audience.
Of course. Then best of luck to you as well.
Thank you so much.
That's a wrap on this week's episode of Maternity Live. As always, you guys know where to find me. DM me, email me, maternitylivepod@gmail.com. Join our Facebook group, Maternity Livers. Now that we know what the liver does, the group is even more poppin'. Wherever you listen to podcasts, subscribe, leave a review, and as always, I will see you next week diving deep into everything under the sun as we navigate this crazy world together. Bye, everyone.